With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public, free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom, and donate today. Visit realitycheck.radio/donate.
Simon Elmer was born in London, but currently lives in Hong Kong. In 2002, he received his PhD in the History and Theory of Art from University College London. He has taught at the universities of London, Manchester, Reading, and Michigan. In 2015, he co-founded Architects for Social Housing, for which he is head of research. And he has a great list of books. And if I go through them all, I'll just burn up time. But the one that we're really interested in talking about, finding out about, is The Great Reset, Biopolitics for Stakeholder Capitalism. Joining us from Hong Kong is Simon Elmer. Hi, Simon. Thanks for coming on.
Hello, Paul. Thanks for having me back.
Yeah, great to have you back, Simon. I should have mentioned we've spoken to you twice on this program already. I think back in late November about The Great Reset, Biopolitics for Stakeholder Capitalism, and also in December, the impact on the global COVID resistance freedom community from the Gaza, as you described it, genocide and war crimes. And that was in early December. So great to have you back. Now, big picture question here, because some people are either unaware or don't believe it. There has been a great reset, right? There has been a great reset. It's happened, right?
Well, yeah, we're in the process of it happening.
Yeah,
it's been going on for quite a long time. Yeah, you hear these people sort of saying, how can we resist the great reset? You know, it's not going to happen. Something is in the future. I mean, it's going on right now, all around us. Yeah.
So when was the start line? When do we cross the line, do you think?
Well, I mean, the word's been around for quite a while, but it kind of really entered into public consciousness, didn't it, after the, you know, after the lockdown. We were told we were going to build back better. All the leaders of industry and all the politicians around the world started using this kind of phrase, we're going to build back better. And the word Great Reset came in as well. It was kind of popularized by the World Economic Forum. I mean, in my kind of understanding, my kind of attempt to write the history of this period since around there, it begins in September 2019, when there's this spike in interest rates on the repo market, which occasions this vast bailing out of financial assets, buying up of financial assets by the central banks of the world, which led to something like, I think, about $11.23 trillion being magicked into existence by the Federal Reserve, and then kind of copied, not to that extent, but by the central banks of China, of Japan, of the EU, and of course the Bank of England. So that, I think, is when the real Great Reset happens. In my understanding of the term, the Great Reset is really the Great Reset of Western capitalism, which after God knows, 40, 50 years of running a fiat economy where you simply magic money into existence, is kind of in a lot of trouble. It's got a huge amount of debt and doesn't really have any way of repaying it.
Would it be a simple way to say it had kind of burnt out?
Yeah. I mean, there's only so long that people are going to buy up government bonds or are going to, accept loans and so on, or take out loans, when you don't think the economy you're borrowing them from is going to improve. Quite recently, six months in the middle of last year, the Federal Reserve was reaching a point where it couldn't pay up. People were going to call in its debts, and they simply didn't have the money to do it. So they extended the debt ceiling again. I had a look yesterday. I think the U.S. Debt at the moment is $33.4 trillion.
On the way to
$34
trillion, yeah.
That's a lot of money. It's a lot of money. And if you don't have an industrial base to build that, like China does, for instance, to pay that back, and your entire economy is based on buying and selling derivatives, government bonds, et cetera, you're in a lot of trouble. And that's where the U.S. is at the moment. And, of course, that means the whole of the West as well. I mean, the U.K. is in an even worse problem in a way in terms of its external debt. Yeah.
Yeah. So I want to get into what connects us with this cell phone, basically. Where does the average Joe Blow, like me, I'm not going to say you because you're higher achieving than me, where do we fit in? I mean, are we any part of this? And if so, what part?
Yeah, I think I guess the way that the we fit in and the smartphone fits in is what we're seeing is a process in which we're going to have a huge reduction in our standard of living. People have been promising that for a long time. There's kind of people who sort of say, we've got to basically get the working classes of the West to have a kind of an income which is coming close to that which it is in China, or perhaps India is a better model or something like that. if you say to if you say to the populations of the West with our innate sense of superiority over the rest of the world, hey, guess what? Western capitalism isn't working out. We're going to have to really reduce your standard of living. Your consumptions are going to go down. Your GDP is going to collapse. You're not going to be able to simply, you know, borrow money to buy homes and cars and utilities and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, people are going to go, hold on. What's going on? There's going to be a lot of, you know, social unrest about it. But if you come up with a sense of a set of excuses to that, like, hey, the world is global boiling, so we're going to have to stop you consuming all these goods because otherwise we're going to kill the planet. Yeah. You know, that's the way you can kind of do it. Or if you say, you know, we've got to fight against Vladimir Putin because he represents a threat to the security of Europe, so we're going to take all your tax dollars and siphon it through arms dealers into the Ukraine and all that sort of stuff. The Western nations kind of like those kind of models of those narratives of sacrifice, I think, which is very important. You know, the whole COVID lockdown thing was done on this sacrifice that you were sacrificing your businesses, your income, your children's health.
So getting used to people, getting people used to making sacrifices.
Yeah, I think. And, you know, soft power is more successful. You know, I guess there's no stronger hard power, I think, than locking people in their homes and threatening them if they come out, we're going to beat you up with police with truncheons. But that's not really a sustainable model of, I guess, totalitarian rule. Totalitarians... states or regimes always work when people believe in that system. So I think at the moment we've got a whole lot of narratives around war, around environmental fundamentalism, around health and viruses, around cybersecurity, all that sort of stuff, which is encouraging very successfully so far Western populations to accept this great reset of Western capitalism into a far more impoverished world.
Okay, then introduce or good time to mention the smartphone.
Yeah.
Okay. the probably one of the, and this is the issue, isn't it? One of the most convenient devices on the planet. So there's
that.
You got
one, Paul. It is a convenient. It is a convenient thing, isn't it? How do I get into smartphones? You know, I don't own one. I never has owned one. Partly because I don't own one.
All the way through.
Yeah, I've never had one. That's partly because, you know, as a writer, I spend most of my day in front of this laptop that I'm looking at now. So when I go out, the last thing I want is another connection to the internet. So originally it was simply about, I guess, my you know, wanting to make a divide between work and play and so on and so forth. I also, but very right from the beginning, I was very struck about how closely people became attached to them. You know, I'd sit down at a table in a pub and all my friends would take out their smartphones and kind of put them on the table. It's like that it's like that scene from American Psycho, isn't it? When all the businessmen get out their credit cards, or not their credit cards, their kind of business cards. Yep. And they all kind of compare their surfaces and stuff like that. But that's kind of normal. You know,
I do that.
You do that, do you?
Well, of course. You know, it's uncomfortable sometimes sitting with it in the pocket. But yeah, I put it on the table. It's always there.
That's the way commodities work. We anthropomorphize them. Yeah, we attribute human qualities to them. They come to stand in for us. They become a kind of a substitute for us. They represent us. They kind of give us a certain status. They also make sure that we belong to a group. You know, do you have this iPhone? Do you have that one? And so on and so forth. So that's kind of par for the course. I think my real change in opinions about smartphones, I mean, my partner has one. She uses it a lot. So I'm always, you know, there was a point when she was using it and putting it under her bed at night, under her pillow, so it could tell her how well she slept the next morning.
What?
I was like, that's a bit creepy, isn't it? It's like, you know, why do you need a machine to tell you how, you know, and began to become more aware of how these things were not simply being anthropomorphized, but they were doing something to us. There was a reciprocal change in us. Let me give you an anecdote. During the lockdown period, I think it was in the second year, where things had kind of lifted a little bit. I was in a pub in South London in a place called Brixton, a pretty lugubrious pub. And I was sitting at the back with my friend near the toilets. And I noticed that everyone who came out of the toilet, almost without exception, say 9 out of 10, the first thing they did when they came out of the toilet door was reach for their pocket and take out their smartphone. And I started to thought, why are they doing that? What is it? And I realized it was a kind of a habit. Why would you get your smartphone out? You're in the pub, you come out of the toilet. You washed your hands? I didn't know. And I began to think there was a program that I saw a long, long time ago, I think in the 70s, or at least it was made in the 70s. I probably saw it later. At a time when cars were really kind of taking over our world, cities were being built more and more around the world, around the car, you know, freeways, motorways, car parks, and so on and so forth. And someone made this kind of documentary, and they said, if aliens came to planet Earth, and they looked at it from a distance, they would think the dominant life form was the car.
Yeah, right.
The human beings were simply a kind of battery, which were placed into it to allow it to move.
Yeah, that every time they got in, it moved.
Yeah, so they moved. Kind of like food is with us. You know, we eat food, and sometimes we're magically able to move around. If you take that food away, it doesn't work. And I began to think about the smartphone as in that kind of inversion, that in fact, we weren't using smartphones. They weren't convenient to us, that they were using us. They were using us to replicate their numbers. They were using us to increase their powers.
Oh, like an organic sort of organism type.
Like we're the organic organism that makes smartphones work.
Yeah.
You know, in the UK, 93% of the population, last time I looked, it's probably 95 by now, has a smartphone. There's also a few percent of you like me who've got a mobile phone, but not a smartphone.
Yeah.
When I looked into the statistics in the US, I think they're from kind of the end of 2022. At the way people use phones, it's said that people use phones on average. This is on average. So this is not the kids who are using it all the time or, I don't know, other people using it. But on average, it's 2,617 times a day that they touch or touch the smartphone. So I worked that out on a 16-hour day. That means the average person is touching their smartphone every 22 seconds. Now, when you say to me and when other people say to me, because when I confront people with this, they're like, well, but it's really convenient. You're not using...
That's what I said before.
That's what you said before.
Oh, the convenience. Yeah.
Now, of course they're convenient. You know, if I'm going to see a friend in a pub and he says, oh, it's this address, I'm going to find out where the address is. If you're an old-fashioned person like me, I have to get out an A to Z map and look it up where that place is. Or I made a map beforehand. It's slightly inconvenient.
Yeah.
You can use it like that.
Slightly,
If you're traveling, if you're driving in a car... and you've lost your way, you get out your Google Maps and you can travel around. It carries your music, it carries your books, it carries your reading, it does all sorts of stuff. But that's not how they're being used. I've been watching them very carefully how they're used. I've just come to Hong Kong. I came 2 months ago, and I've kind of got new eyes. You know, whenever you go to a new place, you see it's different, so you see things differently. I do think the level of addiction, of smartphone addiction here, is worse than it is in London.
So it is an addiction then. We can say like...
I think if you're touching something 22 every 22 seconds of your life,
that is
addictive. That's habitual addictive behavior.
Yeah.
And when I look at... I've been sort of looking over the shoulder of people here on the train, on the platforms, on the escalators, walking down the street. And people hold this smartphone. Everyone holds it in their hand all the time, even when they're not using it. They've kind of got it clutched in their hand. And I look at what they've got on it, and they're not looking up where they're going. They're not trying to find that bookshop, or they're not trying to find the road, or they're not actually communicating with people. They're not making a phone call. It's got just rubbish on it. It's just kind of got, I don't know, images fleeting backwards and forwards, online kind of garbage. It's the kind of the detritus of the online world.
Yeah.
And I was thinking, what is it doing? What sort of function is that playing in their life? And that's what I've been kind of thinking about and writing about and trying to understand what's happening. If we admit that smartphones are convenient and that gives the justification for, you know, owning one, how are they actually functioning in our lives? And that's what I've been trying to discover. I think there's two answers to that question, which we can try and address. One is how they fit into the Great Reset, these new technologies and these new apparatuses of biotech or biopower, as I've called it, we've discussed this before, which subordinates us to the Great Reset, but also how they're changing our consciousness of the world around us, of each other, and also our internal consciousness as well. So those are the sort of stuff, those are the two kind of elements I'm looking at. Well,
I just want to ask you why you think we take to them so naturally. I mean, they're not a natural item. They're, you know, pretty high tech sort of, you know, fourth generation manufacturing product.
Yep.
But we take to them, you know, so naturally.
Yeah, they've only been it's hard to say when the first smartphone started. I think they got connected. I think the first one was kind of 97, 98.
Yeah.
They first got connected to the internet around 2002, maybe. But the first iPhone, you know, the Apple iPhone, came out in 2007, which is, what's that, 17 years ago.
Yeah.
And now, the whole developed world's got it. And a lot of the, you know, developing world on a smartphone, you know, people have written to me and said, you know, social workers who've gone into, you know, very distant villages in Bolivia, and they've got no running water, they've got no roads, they've got no schools, they've got no books, they've got nothing. But everyone in the village has got a smartphone.
Yeah.
You know, they've been given them. So first of all, I don't think it's a natural addiction. I think they've been very deliberately made accessible, very cheap price, far cheaper than they cost to make it, as it were, to encourage.
As part of the configuration of a great reset, is this like a tool that's required, but needs to be used a particular way, perceived in a particular way to be a useful component?
They're very addictive technologies. I mean, if you think of them as a drug. You know, when a dealer first gives you their first piece of drug, they say, hey, take this for free, take this cheap, I'll give you two for one. So first of all, they're made very, very accessible to a lot of people, and particularly to children. Then the actual technology itself is very, very addictive. I don't know exactly how, because I don't have one, but I can see that people around me are completely and utterly addicted to them.
Yeah.
You know, I really want to take some photos of this, but I'll have to use a smartphone to do it because I don't have a camera.
Yeah, you have to get an old style.
When you stand on the platform here, and I'm not picking on Hong Kong, I'm just saying that the level of education here is more advanced than it is in the UK. I don't know what it's like in the US. I haven't been there for many years. Well, I don't know what it's like in New Zealand. But if you stand on a platform here in Hong Kong, you've got 99% of the people standing on the platform staring at their phone. Like this. The thing that I find even more bizarre is that when people are talking to each other, so you've got two friends in the back of a tram I saw the other day, they're talking to each other, but as they're talking, they're also playing on their smartphone at the same time. And then what they do is they take the smartphone and they show what they've seen to the other person. So the smartphone is actually acting as a mediator between them. It's actually becoming a kind of a substitute for their voices. They're communicating through their smartphone.
That's the conscious behavior / conscious change that, or one of them that you're seeing.
That's one element.
And it's a less personal contact, isn't it? Because it's mediating. It's like it's something between the two people
I think it's also, it's not only intervening in people, though. I think it is changing our consciousness. It's creating a kind of a permanently distracted state of consciousness.
Oh, okay.
You know, I used to be an educator, and my partner still is. She teaches here at the Hong Kong University. And, you know, I think everyone in education knows that there's a real problem with children at school having smartphones. It's very hard to get children to concentrate long enough to read a book or a text or a chapter or something like that.
Yeah, huge challenge, I would say. Yeah.
I mean, I think kids are less and less reading books anyway. Everything they're getting is online. When you've got a permanently distracted state of consciousness, when people aren't actually fixed on anything, but they're always kind of looking at the world, talking to someone, and having their phone present in their hand. And I really can't emphasize enough, people walk around here with a phone in their hand the whole time, even when they're not using it. But they use it in their interaction with the world. You've got a very distracted state of consciousness. You're never looking at one thing. I think beyond that, the thing that's even more dangerous is that... As I said, if the average person, that means me and you and everyone else, touches their phone every 22 seconds of a waking day, that means a lot of people, I would say generally it's the young, because the young, they've grown up on this kind of technology. You know, if you're a teenager here, you've never known not being with a smartphone. You know, I've seen kids walking around with kind of miniature versions of smartphones from the very, very young age.
Kid size.
I think what it's doing is kid size. And they're being trained to see the smartphone. You know, I see kids with parents who are showing them their smartphone from a very, very young age, an infant. They're being taught to engage with the smartphone. And I think it's keep creating a kind of a parallel existence, an online existence, which is increasingly taking over the relationship that we have to the real world out there. Now, I think that's very important because part of the Great Reset is restricting our access to the world. Yeah. On a very simple level, we've been told by the WEF, the World Economic Forum, that from now on, we're not going to be able to fly to our favorite holiday destination. Yeah. because it's killing the planet, you know, global boiling and all this kind of rubbish. So what we're going to do is you're going to experience it through a virtual headset.
Oh, okay, so you sit in your darkened lounge.
And... Or, you know, in the UK, they're bringing in these 15-minute cities, which you can restrict how much you can move around your own city.
Talking about them here too, Simon.
The sort of restrictions which are being talked about by environmental fundamentalist groups like the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is about restricting our traveling cars within our own country. You know, the people who are creating the electronic networks which are going to drive the batteries in EVs and electric vehicles have said very openly that if there's a limit to these sources of energy, and we know that electric batteries are incredibly ineffective. Means of power generation, I would say there's absolutely no way they can run the world. But anyway, that they will simply cut off the cars. So they'll turn off the cars. So there's a lot of restrictions on our access to the real world, our consumptions as well, you know, our oil consumption, our petrol consumption, our consumption of dairy products. These are all being justified through various means. Our access to the world, our perception of the world, our means of going into it and our consumption of its resources are all going to be radically reduced, are being radically reduced. That's one of the elements of the Great Reset. If you distance a new generation of children, it's not just happened to children, it's happened to young people, it's happened to us, from the real world, their access to it. If you feel that the real world is not simply the only world out there, but kids are living more and more online, taking the real world away from them is going to be a lot easier, I think. I don't think children who have grown up online to the extent that children are now, where they are literally living almost their entire day with a smartphone in their hand, are going to miss a world which they've never really lived in the first place. I think that's the kind of the dark end of the spectrum.
And then having them living in that kind of world rather than the real world, and I see one of your posts on X sort of covers that with the snow effect painting, an impressionist painting. I think the point is made that it's the only, I think the quote here, the only valid field of experience is that, you know, real world view of like a cityscape or whatever. And the disconnection, attempt to disconnect people from that world, and even though they're kind of physically in it still, and this digital world, how does that help the reset?
Yeah, okay, let's get on to that. Because when you create psychological addiction, which I think we've already got there, you know, specifically and of course, addiction is something where you can control people when you threaten to take it away. You know, there's the WEF is constantly threatening this cyber attack. You know what's going to happen, you know, and all that sort of. When the WF says, "Oh, there's going to be a cyber attack," you can be pretty sure that they're going to.
Well, they always telegraph. They always seem to telegraph what's next, right? Yeah.
They're telling us there's going to be new. But okay, what is the real Great Reset? Is not going to be when you create psychological addiction, you then create technological dependency. Some of the things the Great Reset is going to do through the smartphone is a system of digital ID, which is obviously coming in now. That will be run through a smartphone, initially at least. So if the World Health Organization wants to monitor who is vaccinated according to its own pandemic treaty, if you like, it'll be registering that because we will be required to get a vaccination, if you want to call them those, that's an inverted commas, the kind of the gene therapies. And you'll be required to upload that biometric data onto your digital ID as a means to access to something like a hospital or a school or education or your work or whatever. Okay. If you're going to have a 15-minute city and you're going to monitor how many times people are able to leave it or to move around it in a car or in any other way, the smartphone is going to be the way in which it monitors your movements, how many times you've got your pass, if you like. You know, Oxford City Council now in England at the moment is talking about, you know, they've divided the city up into these different quadrants and you're allowed to move around them 100 times a year. So how do you monitor that? Well, you do it. You can, at the moment, you can do it through the enormous number of cameras you've got in this country, which look at your license plates and stuff. It's easier to do that through a smartphone.
Yeah.
If we look at our carbon footprint, You know, at the WEF again, you've got lots of people saying, how do we measure the carbon footprint, not just of companies, but of individuals? So our consumption of meat, dairy products, energy, oil, petrol, and other products, if you like, these are all going to be cut down by the Great Reset. That's going to be monitored through the smartphone. The compliance with lockdowns, you know, people think lockdown won't happen in the future. I don't believe that at all. I think they will be used. The way to monitor that, you know, before you had to have police going around. If you've got a smart city, you know, you've got this being kind of trialed at the moment in parks and things like that. When people go into the park, they have to use a, you know, scan a QR code with their smartphone in order to access it. And you know, the real doozy, if you like, the real kind of closing of this digital gate around us is, as we've spoken before, central bank digital currency, will be run through our smartphones. So there's other ways it can be used. You know, I could enumerate loads and loads of them. But when you've created addiction, the requirement to do all these things, instead of seen as they would probably be by people of our generation, Paul, are going to be seen as simply a natural extension of the way you move around the city. It's increasingly difficult to get around cities, to access your bank account, to move into a building, to buy a ticket to something, to go and see a movie, to get a seat, to access healthcare without a smartphone. Mm. I mean, I'm in Hong Kong here. I'm on a tourist visa. I've managed to open a bank account here, but I can't get online banking.
Right.
I've got a laptop, but I can't because I have to download an app on a smartphone. So straight away there, I don't have access to my own kind of banking thing. And I've asked, this is kind of crazy. And they said, well, that's the way it is. Recently, I was looking into figures on this thing called eHealth, which they have in Hong Kong. It's an electronic health system. And between 2020 and 2023, the membership of it increased by something like 783%, so eightfold increase in the number of Hong Kongers who have signed up to it. They did it, of course, because the vaccination program, the COVID vaccination program, required them to sign up to eHealth in order to get vaccinated. The way that you register for eHealth is, of course, through your smartphone, if you haven't got one. So we talked, you know, and I don't know if listeners want to go back, but we've talked before about this concept of biopower. This stuff is not being legislated for. There's no legislation going through telling people to do this. You're not saying, unless you get a phone, you can't get online banking.
Yeah.
There'd be an outrage over
well,
it.
You don't need to, though, right?
You don't need to do it. You simply make it a requirement of these new technologies and the apparatuses around them. That is, the institutions that impose them, the discourses which are justifying them. And the smartphone is the key to that. Let me just say one more thing. One of the key indicators of addiction is people denying that they're addicted. And when I kind of say this sort of stuff, and I'm getting known for this, I think, because I keep rattling on about it because it's kind of striking me more and more. People say a number of things. First of all, they go, but I'm reading this through my smartphone. So I write about this on Twitter. They say, I'm reading about it.
Yeah.
And now that's kind of saying, I'm writing this on Twitter. I don't have a smartphone. So there's a kind of a misunderstanding that the smartphone is simply a mobile laptop. It's not. It's a very different.
That's how I've thought of it up till recently.
It's a very different instrument. You don't use your laptop to scan a QR code to get into a building or to access different parts of stuff. So we have to understand that they're very different types of tools. One is a tool. The other thing that people say is, well, the mobile phone is a tool like any other. You can use it badly, or you can use it wisely. Again, I disagree with that. The laptop's like that. You know, I spend too much time in front of my laptop. We all do, don't we? We all spend too much time on our screens. But the addiction to smartphones is a different thing. It's directed towards another end. I think there's a biopolitical dimension to smartphone addiction, which is different to spending too much time in front of a TV or a laptop, because the way they're being used as part of the reset, this kind of the Great Reset, this apparatus. Go on.
I was going to ask you, so what happens? Okay, you're a good example because you don't have one. What happens in this environment if you don't have one of these devices? Are you essentially sort of locked in?
It's getting difficult, you know. It's getting difficult. You know, I mean, in terms of convenience, I take the trouble. You know, I go out and buy maps. If I'm going somewhere, I draw a little map. I draw a little diagram in my.
Someone looking at a map. There. How quaint! All right.
I know. I'm a weirdo who reads books on the train and things like that. Getting access to money is kind of weird. Over here, there's all sorts of strange sort of payment ways. It's just new. It's different to London. So I'm having to get cash out with a bank card, and then use that cash to put on a payment card, which gives me access to payment things and stuff like this. But, that's the price I have to pay. I'm getting more worried where I'm getting lack of access to things. I find it very upsetting, very worrying that I don't have access to online banking. So I don't really know what's going on in my bank. That's something which disturbs me, and there doesn't seem to be a way I can get around that. When the other day I bought a new phone, because my old one is kind of conking out. This is my old one from 2003. Yeah. And I bought a new one, which is almost exactly the same. It's a Nokia. It's 4G, so it's a new phone, but it doesn't have access to the internet. So it doesn't kind of, and I can't scan QR codes. It doesn't have a phone, a camera and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
Over here, to buy a phone, I have to hand over my ID. In the UK, you can still call what we call burners.
burner phones. Yep.
And absolutely nobody knows you've got it. Over here, the smartphone, or any phone at all, is linked to, I had to use my passport for it. So the guy who I bought it off of took a picture of my passport as well.
Wow.
So everything I do on that phone is now accessed, linked to my ID as well. So there is a growing net, a web of apparatuses and technologies. And the smartphone is the way they connect us, our biology, our bodies, our movements, our behaviors, our speech, our comments, our opinions, our conscience to this growing, network. What do they call it? They call it the network of things, isn't it? The
Internet of things. I think,
Internet of things. That's the word. And the Internet of Things is growing. The cameras, the surveillance, the QR codes, the requirements to access the world, and the smartphone is the key to that. And I don't know why people can't see it, because I think they don't see it because the addiction has preceded the requirement, and therefore they can't see it. When I stand on a train, I'm on a train here, and I look around, and every single person on the carriage, and they're big long trains, is staring at their phone.
Yeah.
Nobody's
yeah.
talking to each other. Nobody's looking to each other.
No.
I'm amazed that nobody can see it. I think some people can when I mention it to them, but most people can't see it, and that is the side of addiction, isn't it?
Well, it's too late then, isn't it? Because
I don't think it is. I don't think it is too late. How much time have we got? One of the things I'm really interested in is the link between the phone, the smartphone, and face masks.
Oh, okay, that's interesting. Yeah,
yeah. I think there's a. There's a German writer, you've probably heard of him, called Walter Benjamin. He lived in the 20s and 30s. He was a kind of a cultural critic, and he came up with this idea of what he called the dialectical image. And what he wanted to do is he wanted to correct very reductive ideas, Marxist ideas, that somehow all culture is simply a mirror image reflection of economic relations. Yeah. And I think one of the ways he was trying to challenge is, how the hell did Hitler rise to take over Germany, which was the most advanced industrial and scientific, probably a philosophical country in Europe, probably in the world. Mm. And yet it was taken over by a political movement of people dressed in Boy Scout suits, doing nighttime marches through, the streets, carrying, all this, and talking about an Aryan race and all this sort of stuff. So clearly here, politics and culture was not simply mirroring the economics of that society. So we developed this idea of the dialectical image, in which the relationship between the economics, so in our terms, in our times, it's the Great Reset, and its cultural manifestations. And he says that relationship is always mediated through political structures, cultural structures, and I would say in our time, medical discourse. You had the same in the Nazi era as well, where there was a kind of a medical discourse around race, around, disease and so on and so forth.
It's kind of familiar,
It's very, very familiar. Now, over here, I think to understand the ubiquity of the smartphone, we also have to understand the ubiquity of masks as well. I think the dialectical image through which we can understand this present historical moment is the figure of someone with a mask on, a medical mask on, a surgical mask, which is used exclusively, built exclusively for use in a sanitized environment when someone is performing surgery to stop their breath turning into drops and going into a wound. Now, that is all they're made for.
Into an open heart.
That's the only thing. They do absolutely nothing. They have absolutely no medical justification for wearing them. But that's not why people are wearing them. It's the same way that people are using smartphones, not because they're convenient, because they're addicted to it. That image of the masked person using a smartphone. Now, the justification for wearing a mask now is that after 500 million years of evolution, the human immune system is suddenly insufficient. It's defunct. Yeah. It's been declared. It's not going to protect us. It's developed over 500 million years, which is longer than Homo sapiens have been around. But it now doesn't work. So we need a kind of an adjunct to us. The human biology is somehow deemed to be insufficient and a danger to itself and others. So we have this prosthetic device, which is a plastic mask worn over our face. And now it's gone way beyond people thinking about it in that way. I think it's become a signifier of a certain status, not just merely of compliance, but of virtue as well. I think people wear it to advertise to other people, this is who I am. So it's it's a fashion statement in a way.
It's a performance.
It's a performance, and it identifies you as having a certain set of values and so on and so forth. That's why the left is
I see someone think you're obviously clearly insane, but okay.
I think that as well, but, and it's very hard to communicate with these people. And I think the smartphone works in a similar way. They both predicated on the idea that humans are insufficient, that we are no longer capable of making decisions for ourselves. We can't navigate our way around a city. We can't drive to our parents' house in the country or something like that, if they live there, mind you. We can't make decisions about whether we should go into a certain building. All these decisions are being taken away from us because the human being has been deemed incapable of making judgments for itself. Now, Hannah Arendt, the great German political theorist who escaped from Nazi Germany, she wrote her famous book, The Origins of Totalitarianism. And she said, the ultimate goal of all forms of totalitarianism is to render the human being superfluous to its own functioning. Smartphones are doing that. I can't gain access to, like, for instance, I go onto Twitter, the judgment made by Twitter that anything that I write there is going to suddenly be censored or shadow banned and so on, that's not being made by little people sitting there typing in and reading my post. It's being programmed in by algorithms which will identify subjects they don't want discussed. These are the same algorithms which are working with our smartphones to grant us access to this world which is being taken away from us. The predicate of that is that human beings are no longer capable of running their own world, of making their own decisions, of judging what should and shouldn't go into their body, of where they can move, what they consume. We are being made redundant to this. And this takes me back to my first image. We are not using smartphones. They are using us. Yeah. Every time we use them, every time we log on, every time we go into a petrol station, a library, any time we log on, every time we use this great network, we are handing over our data to this vast harvesting apparatus, which is increasing the knowledge that information technology companies have of us. And as many, many leaders in the corporate world have said, the most valuable commodity in the world right now, it's not oil, it's not steel, it's data, it's information about us. And they're taking, every time we're using this, the phones are using us to compile this data. And all it does is increasing the sophistication, the extent, and the power of this digital camp, which is enclosing us in the world.
Okay, a couple of final questions. Early on, you talked about the capitalist system, I guess, and I made the point that maybe it's burnt out.
Yeah.
So I can see how you would want to limit the collateral damage to the elite in the event of a collapse of that by distributing the losses and the poverty amongst the masses. But just in hearing what you just said then about kind of the dehumanizing part of it, what's the point of even having people if they're in the state? I mean, what's the upside? What do you get? What do you get? Some physical labor or chores done, or what do you get?
Well, there's a lot of people who appear to be running the world, who are talking about programs of depopulation, aren't they? There's, you know, people are openly getting up. You know, Bill Gates has been saying for years the way to reduce the population of the world. And he's always walking around Africa, isn't he, kind of testing out his vaccines and stuff. And they've got programs for that. You know, you've got people like Yuval Harari, who we've spoken about before, the Israeli transhumanist and advisor to Klaus Schwab.
I was thinking of him when you were talking just before.
Yeah, who says very openly, you know, that he talks about them, the population, most of the population of the world being kind of useless mouths, useless eaters.
Useless
and
eaters.
Finding ways to kind of handle them. What are we going to do with them? Are there programs of mass depopulation? When you've got people like, what's his name, John Kerry, the U.S. envoy to, you know, environmental envoy, sort of saying that, you know, the only way to reduce the carbon footprint and achieve this kind of chimerical, you know, nirvana of net zero, which I think is a genocidal project, is to reduce the food production in the world. I guess, like most Americans who eat a lot too much food, you seem to think food is some sort of kind of optional extra to most of the world. Most of the world is actually still just about getting enough food to eat. And I think when he talks about reducing food production, I think I know who he means it for. He doesn't mean for his mates in Washington. He means for the third world or the developing world or the global south and so on. So I think they have got plans for people, and it is a kind of a depopulation one. You know, you did ask me about, you did say, you know, what can we do?
Because I don't think people are going to throw away the phones just yet.
Actually. They're not going to throw away the phones, but we can educate people in what they're doing. I think, you know, one of the things about biopower is what was once obligated, regulated by legislation and enforced by things like the police and so on, becomes adopted as voluntarily. In the Hong Kong, they had a very long lockdown, very severe one. Lockdown restrictions, and one of them was that children were required to wear face masks at school for 3 years.
Wow.
Now, do you remember when you were a kid, 3 years, I mean, 1 year seemed like forever, didn't it? Three years. They lifted it last in 2023, February 2023. They lifted the mandates. Yet, I mean, this is just from anecdotal, but where I live in Hong Kong, there's a lot of school children around here, a lot of schools, a lot of inner city schools, lots of little kids running around, and almost all of them are wearing masks still.
So it's now become part of...
It's become the new normal. It's become the norm. And it's actually become a virtue. It's not just become something you do because it's habitual. It's become a virtue to do it. Now, as we know, children are statistically immune because to anything like COVID or whatever. They have the strongest, you know, immune systems. They've got amazing immune systems. Nobody dies. No kid statistically dies.
Yeah, so there's no reason for wearing them.
There's absolutely no reason for wearing them at all. Even if they worked. That's even if they worked, which of course they don't, because that's not what those masks were made for. Even if you were wearing a mask which could stop a virus which is 1/10,000th of a millimeter wide, which they don't, it would still be pointless putting it on children. Now, I think one of the things that have failed us is education, the education system. I think all schools and universities should ban children from wearing, that's from the age of, you know, kindergarten or all the way up, from wearing masks when they're at school. You can't tell them what to do when they're at home. If their parents think they should do it, that's unfortunate, but you can't tell parents what to do, I think. And you should ban them from using smartphones once they're in the school gates. You can't change it afterwards. The way you break addictions is two ways. First of all, you stop it becoming habitual. In other words, you make periods in the day where you do not use a smartphone and you do not wear a mask. Yeah? So it doesn't become normalized. It actually becomes abnormal. It's like, oh, I'm just leaving the gate. Do I put the mask back on? Do I get my phone out straight away? The other thing is schools should do what is the most important pedagogical job in the world right now. And that is to teach children of all ages why masks are worn and why they shouldn't be worn. And in other words, to explain to them, you can only do it as a child. You're a very young child. You can say, these smart masks don't do this. We're going to tell you why they're actually made, how they function, and why they don't do what you've been told they do. They don't stop a virus. It's quite easy to demonstrate that. There's lots of videos out there doing it. You should also tell them why they shouldn't use smartphones. You should introduce them to, you know, there's lots of different ways that inventive pedagogical strategies could show the dangers that smartphones have, where they're blocking them from speaking to their fellow kids. You know, children are already, there's lots of data of children talking about their sense of psychological dependency on these phones. And it is not a pleasure. That's the trouble with addiction. It starts as a pleasure, and it quite quickly becomes unpleasurable, becomes displeasing, and it eventually becomes very, very painful. And I think children are already recognizing that, the level of, I mean, I don't like using that word mental health because that itself is a biopolitical kind of a discourse. But if we accept the kind of data that's coming out of the measurements of mental health, the mental health of children is going downhill very, very rapidly. If you can make them realize that a lot of that is caused by smartphones and what that opens them up to, that's what I think education institutions should be doing. So I don't think we're lost. We can reclaim this space, and it's the social space itself, away from these technologies. But I think to do that is not through just banning smartphones. It's also banning masks as well. Because as I said, I think, but they're interdependent upon each other. And I think they're mixed, their ubiquity is closely linked. And I think if you show how they're linked, people, starting with the people, the educators themselves, who are fantastically naive about this, teachers, lecturers and so forth, teach them why this is a bad thing and what the connection is. And that should be, I think every state in the world should have an education program which makes that the most important thing that they can teach children.
Yeah, and I'm just thinking back to when I had young kids, and it was when they were really going heavy about, you know, shutting down smoking. Yeah. And they would come home, so they used to smoke a bit, and they were going, you're not supposed to do that. That's not good for you. That's going to kill you. But the thing is, though, it actually had an effect, you know, repetition of that. So taking away smartphones, the mask, that is the circuit breaker for resetting or offsetting or reverse setting the reset fundamentally.
Yeah.
But you've got to be,
if, let's say hypothetically, everyone in the world threw away their smartphone, or 50% of the people with smartphones stopped using them and went and got a different type of phone. You know, let's not go cold turkey. Let's move on to a different type of phone.
Because that's useful.
You can do that. You know, the Great Reset would be set back a long way. I think it would really cause an enormous barrier to it. But the process of educating people why they should not use a smartphone, even if it starts off with just mental health and addiction and doesn't go on to all the stuff that I've been saying about this great big bad, you know, which will be denounced as a conspiracy theory, even though it's happening all around us. If you just do that, you're breaking the addiction, because I think the Great Reset, the way it's being run through phones, smartphones, is predicated, it's based on this prior psychological addiction, which is now coming to complete fruition. If we can break the addiction, we can break people's compliance with the big apparatus of the Great Reset. So, yeah, I don't think we're lost. We just need some people to empower, to actually recognize the dangers of these. You know, at the moment, there's a lot of people talking about, you know, people studying why there's this huge rise in suicide attempts in mental health, particularly amongst the young. And they're putting it down to all sorts of things, you know, online bullying, blah, 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 blah. But they're not looking at the technologies through which that is happening. Yeah. It's not happening through laptops. It's happening through smartphones. In Hong Kong, 90% of the population over the age of 10 owns a smartphone. But 98% of the population, that's 7.5 million people, that's bigger than New Zealand, isn't it, I suppose? 98% of the population, their only access to the internet is through a smartphone.
Yeah.
So people are using it to get online. Instead of trying to legislate the contents of what is online, and there's a lot of new legislation coming to do that. You know, in the UK, we've got the Online Safety Act, which is incredible, is incredible justification for incredible infringements on our freedom of speech and so on and so forth. This is how they're being used. Instead of doing that, why don't you stop the means through which this stuff
is? It's a no-brainer. When you put it like that,
doesn't it?
Yeah.
And that's, of course, why they aren't doing it. Because, you know, the other thing about the smartphone is convenience creates compliance. When you're used to getting your news, your opinions about the world off this thing, which you used to live with, which is everything but an extension of yourself.
Yeah.
It's very easy to control public opinion about everything from the Ukraine to killer virus to Gaza to whatever.
Yeah. Exactly. You can shape the world.
Yeah. It's a form of propaganda. It's a medium of propaganda that Joseph Goebbels only dreamed of.
Yeah. Well, they had just little radios back then.
Yeah, they had radios and then movie theaters, and that's it.
Yeah. Next
level. This is a movie theater and a radio, which is in your popular subject population's face all the time. So, yeah.
Simon Elmer, no one can say you weren't warned. Okay, you've heard yeah. Simon Elmer, you were warned, yeah. Man.
We need to act now. We need to act now.
Well, you see, you're challenging me, really, because I've got one. Mm. And it is my thinking, I think, that, boy, life would be tough without it, you know. But in the end, what do you do?
It'd be tougher, but it wouldn't be tough.
Yeah.
It'd be tougher, I think, if I can say that.
Go for one of those Nokias again, just retro sort of experience. Simon Elmer, The Great Reset, Biopolitics for Stakeholder Capitalism. Nice to have you back on RCR. Thanks so much.
Okay, thank you very much, Paul. Speak to you soon.
If Reality Check Radio enriches your day in life, support us to keep bringing you the content, voices, perspectives, and the dose of reality you won't get anywhere else. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.